Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
This episode of Steve Austin's show is brought to you free today by our friends at BetOnline.ag. August is lights out with intense sports action going on in Major League Baseball, the UFC, and now the NFL with the preseason underway. Get in the mix at BetOnline.ag and use the promo code PODCAST1 for your 50% welcome bonus. BetOnline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partner of Podcast One Sportsnet.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He started in a small town in Texas. Worked his ass off to become one of the most famous wrestlers of all time.
We're gonna take care of business tonight, and that's the bottom line.
And now, he's dominating the world of on-demand audio.
And he's doing it for the working man.
This is a damn good outlet for me to spew the bullshit off my brain.
Yeah!
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
Hey, welcome to another classic episode of the Steve Austin Show. Every week, we are bringing out some of the most requested episodes of the podcast from behind the archives. We have another great one for you this week, and here's my producer, Sean, to tell you all about it.
What's good, folks? It is producer Sean with another classic episode of the Steve Austin Show. Today, we are doing episode number 384 with one of the greatest Intercontinental Champions of all the times, Santino Marella. Original air date, December 8th, 2016. Yeah, Santino, you just saw him recently on the Raw reunion. He took part in that. And a couple years ago on this podcast, Steve and Santino got together to talk about a whole bunch of stuff in the wrestling business and outside of the wrestling business. Santino just actually started doing some hunting around the time of this interview. So him and Steve talk a little bit about that. But Santino did have neck surgery that eventually he was no longer wrestling because of that. He stepped away from full-time competition in the ring and now is instructing folks in pro wrestling in Battle Arts, the promotion that he works for up in Toronto. Santino and the man himself, Anthony Carelli, doing quite well for themselves in the post-wrestling world. But Santino, I'm just going to call him Santino, very well versed in judo. He's been doing judo for a very long time, as he talks about in this interview. And if you are a fan of Game Changer Wrestling and Josh Barnett, Josh Barnett's Bloodsport 2 takes place on September 14th in Atlantic City. And Anthony Carelli, the man behind Santino Marella, is going to be participating in that event. Also, Steve and Santino talk about the character of Santino Marella, what are the origins of it, as well as Santino's affinity for comedy in wrestling, something that the WWE Universe remembers him very fondly for. Pretty good episode here today with the one and only Santino Marella here on the Steve Austin Show. Also, before we get to this day in history, just wanted to point out Steve Austin's show on USA, on the USA Network, Straight Up Steve Austin, is every Monday night after Raw right now. Check it out. He's had some fun guests on. Sal Vulcano from Impractical Jokers, Rob Riggle. So he's got a lot of cool stuff coming up on that show, and you should check it out right after Raw on Monday nights on the USA Network. Let's get Steve a season two of Straight Up Steve Austin. Also, this past Tuesday, we dropped an episode of the Steve Austin Show with Ric Flair. And Ric Flair has been on the podcast multiple times before, but this is a heck of an episode, if I must say so myself. You guys got to check it out. They pay great tribute to the late Harley Race and just some great stories from the one and only Nature Boy, Ric Flair. I highly encourage you to give that a listen if you haven't done so yet. All right, let's do it. This day in Steve Austin history, today being August 22nd. We start off in WCW in 1991 in Asheville, North Carolina. It's WCW TV champion Stunning Steve Austin battling Dustin Rhodes to a time limit draw. Then we go to 1992 in Monroe, Louisiana. WCW TV champion Steve Austin defeated Ricky the Dragon Steamboat. 1993 in Williamson, West Virginia, WCW tag team champions Arn Anderson and Paul Roma squaring off against Steve Austin and because Brian Pillman had a substitute. I don't know who that substitute was. I don't even know if they won the match. Probably not, because they weren't the champions at the time. But that's when it went down in 1993. We jump over to the WWF in 1996 in Chatham, Ontario, Canada. WWF World Champion Shawn Michaels defeated Stone Cold Steve Austin. 1998 in Albany, New York, it's WWF World Champion Stone Cold Steve Austin defeating The Undertaker and Kane in a triple threat match. And finally, in 1999 in Minneapolis, Minnesota, it's SummerSlam 1999. featuring the main event of Mankind defeating WWF World Champion Stone Cold Steve Austin and Triple H in a triple threat match. Special referee for that match, former Steve Austin show guest, Jesse the Body Ventura, who was the Minnesota governor at the time. Shane McMahon came out to kind of take over the duties of the referee spot from Ventura after he refused to count a cover by Triple H after Triple H used a chair. And Shane got thrown out like yesterday's trash by the Body. And after the match, after it was all said and done, China and Triple H beat up Steve Austin pretty good, attacking his knees with a steel chair before it was all over. And Steve did not show up the next night on Raw, and that opened a door, I guess, for Triple H to challenge Mankind to a WWF world title match, which he won. And that was the very first world title that Triple H won here in the WWF. So yeah, quite the day today and this day in Steve Austin history. All right, folks, thanks for listening. We'll come right back after the break with another classic episode featuring Steve Austin and Santino Marella.
When it comes to pain on a scale of 1 to 10, where are you at? After years of taking bumps in the ring, I've had my fill of aches and pains that still linger to this day. Most days are pretty good. Usually, I'm about a 1. But some days are rough, and it's those times when I just need some relief. Well, check it out. My guys at BioWave set me up with their BioWave Go device. This gimmick uses patented high-frequency neurostimulation pain-blocking technology that delivers therapeutic electrical signals through the skin into deep tissue right to the surface of pain fibers. Now, if you didn't catch all that, basically what I'm saying is that BioWave Go blocks that pain deep at the nerve for up to 24 hours from just one 30-minute treatment. This is different than the old-school TENS units as it goes above and beyond and the results last longer. I've been using my BioWave Go on my back, my neck, and a few other places, and I can tell you it is the real deal. BioWave Go is 100% drug-free pain relief. It's FDA-cleared and currently used by most professional sport teams in the NFL, NHL, NBA, MLB, and NCAA programs. So give the Heisman stiff arm to all those smelly creams and other pain relief gimmicks. It's time to step it up and use what the pros use. Learn more at BioWaveGo.com. And if you're on board, and you should be, try BioWave Go with a no-risk 30-day money-back guarantee plus free shipping. Again, that's BioWaveGo.com. BioWaveGo.com. Check it out today and start living a fuller, pain-free life because I said so.
This is Steve Austin, Unleashed.
All right, man, I'm sitting here rolling sound. I'm out here at the Broken Skull Ranch in the middle of nowhere. It's deer season. It's just got finished raining about 4 or 5 inches. We're trying to do work here at the compound. I got a direct message from an old friend, Santino Marella, and he said he just took up hunting. And I said, man, it would be really interesting to catch up with this guy. And I said, hey, man, what's your phone number? And do you have time to talk? And he said, yeah, I got time to talk. And he's busy as hell right now. But anyway, Santino, welcome to the show. How are you and where are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm in Mississauga, Ontario, which is right beside Toronto. I'm doing awesome. 3 years ago, I knew my neck was kind of, the clock was ticking. So I opened up Battle Arts Academy. And then when my contract expired, so I hit the ground running and I'm just out here doing my battle arts thing. And I just started on Sportsnet. So I'm kind of, you know, dividing up my time pretty nicely. I am really busy, crazy busy.
When you say Sportsnet, what is that? Is that a sports station there? Are you broadcasting? What are you doing?
Yeah, it's a national station and they show, you know, hockey and Blue Jays and they have a show. This company shows the WWE product. Both Raw and SmackDown in Canada, they have the license for it. So then we do a show called Aftermath, where we just kind of critique our wins and fails about, you know, like the last show. You know who else does the show? Jimmy Corderas. He's on the show.
Oh, man. Tell Jimmy I said hello. He was a friend way back in the day, and he ref many of my matches, and it was awesome as a referee.
Yeah, he's great.
Hey, man, last time I saw you, we were catering at a WWE event. I don't remember if you were working full-time or you were working part-time or what your capacity was, But we were sitting there, and we were talking neck surgeries, because it seems like everybody with a neck surgery just kind of, you trade war stories, or you trade, hey, how you feeling,
yeah.
What's your process, you know, what was your procedure, what's going on, how you feeling, how are your extremities, you know the deal. And
yeah,
I was talking to you, you said you had a screw kind of backing out, and I was like, oh, man, I think you were eating an apple, or I was eating lunch, but I was like, man, that doesn't sound good. And it turns out, I guess you had, what, three different neck injuries? So how is your neck now, and how did you get in the position you're at with your neck with respect to the surgery?
My neck was, it wasn't one occurrence. Like yours, I remember, was one major occurrence. This was wear and tear. So I was doing judo since 9 years old. We had to do a million neck bridges. And then I wrestled in high school and university. I actually herniated a disc in university. I had a little take a year off competition. So I was always protecting my neck. I knew it was there. I worked around it. I wouldn't do crazy things and backflips and land on my head and everything. And I would get these flare-ups where, like, I couldn't move at all. I was always pretty good with my extremities. That wasn't a problem. It was a localized pain. And, you know, they sent me to see, originally it was Dr. Youngblood. He did an MRI. And he told me that you don't need surgery yet. And I'm like, yet. I didn't know it was that bad, and then basically the time between flare-ups got shorter and shorter. And one day I was about to wrestle Jack Swagger, and I'm warming up, and I look at the doc, and I can't move my neck like a half inch either direction. Like I can't go out there. And then it was time to make the decision. And so I got a double fusion. And a double fusion, there's no guarantee you can come back, but I couldn't come back to, like, let's say, play football. But because, you know, we're sports entertainment, there's an opportunity to come back. And then it just didn't get to the point where, well, yeah, no, then I had the issue where two screws came out. And when they did the follow-up x-ray, they saw them coming out. And they're, you know, saying that, oh, they'll probably just get locked in with scar tissue, and that would be the end of it. But if it progresses and if you get some throat pain, you know, let us know immediately, because if that screw rotates and punctures your esophagus, it would have been super bad, like eating out of tubes in the hospital for 6 months bad. So one day we're at Tribute to the Troops. I'm with Damian Sandow, and all of a sudden it felt like I got strep throat in about 15 minutes. And I said, oh, no, this is what he talked about. So I made the call. They flew me in the next day, and they took out all the titanium. Luckily, 3 months had passed by, so it fused, and I didn't have to get the hard collar. And, it wasn't completely fused, but it was enough to walk around without a collar. And then I just tried to, get myself well enough to come back, and it just never got to the point where I was well comfortable enough to do a back, consistent back bumps.
Well, you know, it's funny, not funny, but, once I got dropped on my head, and I'd already had spinal stenosis, a narrow spinal canal, didn't have a whole lot of space. So, I was already in harm's way to begin with. And then, when I got dropped on my head, I bruised my spinal cord. And then I was at the time seeing a real famous doctor out of New Jersey area, Dr. Torg, Joseph Torg, who was kind of at the forefront of quadriplegia type accidents. And that's an axial load on the top of the head. And he was saying, Steve, he goes, I really don't feel good about you getting back in the ring. This is very dangerous. You could be paralyzed. This is the number one way people turn into quadriplegics, the accident that you had. This is what happened to Christopher Reeve. And I said, but doc, I said, I can control the bumps that I take. I don't have to do all that stuff. I don't have to take a pile driver. He goes, oh, you don't? Because he didn't know that it was a work. And I said, doc, I said, it's cool. He goes, well, if you're telling me that, then you can go back into the ring. And this is after about 3 or 4 months of being on the sidelines. And then, I still had, intense pain in my anterior delts where my shoulders were still burning. But once he understood that I can control my destiny with respect to bumps in the ring, he cleared me to get back in the ring. And, of course, I made it till about 2000, and that's when I had to get C3-4 fused. I was originally going to be a three-level candidate, but Youngblood went a conservative route and just fused the one. So anyway,
IE's back into the ring, and it was a little nervous at first, just starting to take bumps again. Anybody that has a neck injury is going to be a little hesitant when they first come back. But it sounds like you were really coming back a little bit on the early side. You know, what were your thoughts trying to get back in the ring when you weren't sure about how your neck was, going to take the pain, the punishment, and the stuff that you were going to put it through?
Yeah, well, it's funny because, we always push ourselves more than we probably should. But that's just the nature of the beast. Those are the type of, that's the type of people we are. And, God forbid I'm like, I'm not a pussy, fuck. I got to get in there and train. But I had let's say I tripped on something and put my hand on the table and I still got a stinger. Because I was a candidate for three levels also. But they said, if you do three, then there's no chance you can get back. So the level below, which is like C7T1, is also pretty bad. So I think that was the reason I couldn't get back. If it was only two levels and I fused two levels, possibly. But yeah, it was hard, because I'd have good days where I'm like, okay, no, I'm good, and I can do some stuff. And then I had obviously some moments where I'm like, it's not worth it. And also, if I was 27, I probably would have taken the chance. But, I'm 42, so what's the point now?
Yeah, but you said you went down to see Youngblood, and then you ended up getting a surgical procedure by someone else. So
Dr. Maroon.
Yeah, Maroon. But when I first, initially got dropped on my head, I was flying all over the country, and especially when it was come time for surgery. And finally, when I found Dr. Youngblood through my personal physician in San Antonio, I was like, hey, man, this is the guy. And so, but I did my due diligence as far as getting second, third opinions. Did you seek out, Maroon is the one that did your surgery, but did you get a second, third opinion so that you felt comfortable with what was going on?
I guess there was a team of doctors there, Jeff Bowes, Dr. Maroon, and I guess I trusted in them maybe a little more than I should have. But I knew that it was obviously a very serious issue because my disc, which had calcified and become a piece of bone, was touching my spinal cord. So if anyone, it came to the point where I'd lock up and if I get like shocks of like lightning down my spine. And it just, the last thing was Rusev gave me one of those, the accolade, like the camel clutch.
Yeah.
And it was pulling my head back and it was, and I tap and he holds on to it longer. And the pain was ridiculous. And that was actually my last match. It just flared up and I couldn't move. I could not move at all. So I knew in my heart that something had to be done. And I guess that's why I kind of trusted their opinion. The only thing that bothers me is, over tightening the screws or whatever you did. That's, come on, can't be doing that.
Well, how are you with riding off in the sunset and hanging it up and moving on to the next endeavor?
You know what? I was actually surprisingly really good with it. And one of the reasons was when I was off with my neck, I was home focusing on battle arts. So I really literally hit the ground running. And when it was kind of like I was talking to my wife, I'm like, man, if I go back on the road, it's going to be tough because I'm managing this and that. And then it was a nice, neat 10-year career. I had a definite life before and I'm looking forward to life after wrestling. I miss obviously being with the boys on the road and Googling a local Gold's Gym and a Denny's and that kind of stuff. But that's really the only, I miss the actual matches, of course. But the BS and long days at TVs and all that stuff. I don't miss that too much.
Man, I always thought that you were so damn funny in character. I just thought you were natural for a TV series or some acting. Did you ever pursue that? And did you ever have some bites or nibbles at that?
I did the one movie with Larry the Cable Guy called Jingle All the Way 2. I actually just got my headshots last week. So I just got a local agent for the first time. And I'm going to try to do some cameos and some commercials or even small parts. Because Toronto, they call it Hollywood North because of the tax incentives. There's at any time, 10-20 movies taking place in the city. So there's a lot of work up here, and I don't want to commit to something too long, but I'll definitely go do some cameos. I enjoy acting. I enjoyed playing the character Santino, and the only problem was that I was one character, and I always wanted to challenge myself and have many different roles, but when it came to Santino, I just, I was one character.
Hey, man, how did you come up with that character? I mean, we did a segment together when The Condemned came out. And, of course, boy, you just thought it was the worst thing in the world. And there's a couple times I almost lost it in the ring, and the crowd was really buying in. And how did you create the Santino Morelli character? I know how you got the name. I can read Wikipedia and find that out. Tell me about the character, because it was outrageous, and it was just awesome.
Yeah, it's funny. So it's basically geographically influenced, because growing up here in Mississauga, pretty much all my friends, their parents are from other countries. So my best friend's Croatian, my neighbor is Greek, my dad came from Italy. Across the street, Portuguese. So I went to this high school of all first-generation Canadians, and all our parents have these accents, and they, you know, try and show the kids that they know the language, and they'll say funny expressions, and they'll butcher it. And, well, Santino was first a baby face, and it kind of wasn't really catching on. They had some doubts there. So then, you know, they said, well, let's turn him heel, and if that doesn't stick, then who knows, maybe repackage. And Vince just thought that me being a heel with this accent was hilarious. So that bought me enough time to kind of then to get to know the character and develop the backstory of where he's from. And it's funny. Santino kind of evolved over the years. It was a little bit Nacho Libre for a couple of years. It was a little bit Borat for a couple of years. And he kind of morphed a little bit.
Was Borat influential in that character at all? Or
I think it's just the fact that it's that immigrant, broken language type character, you know, kind of almost universal accent, you know.
Once you developed the Santino character, the gimmick, and when you were in character, did you feel in a safe zone? Because I never saw you break character, and you seemed very comfortable in it, and that's who and what you were.
That's funny that you say that, because I cannot screw up as Santino. It's a fail-proof gimmick. He's an idiot. Even if he makes a mistake, it's okay because it's Santino. Yeah, no, it's funny because when I'm being asked questions as myself, you know, I can often stumble or say, I have to think about it. But when I'm Santino, the answers are immediate, and they're funnier than when I'm just being me.
Make sure to stick around after this podcast to get the latest headlines from the AP News Minute.
Everyone knows about the risks of driving drunk. You could get in a crash, people could get hurt or killed. But let's take a moment to look at some surprising statistics. Almost 29 people in the United States die every day in alcohol-impaired vehicle crashes. That's one person every 50 minutes. Even though drunk driving fatalities have fallen by a third in the last three decades, drunk driving crashes still claim more than 10,000 lives each year. Drunk driving can have a big impact on your wallet, too. You could get arrested and incur huge legal expenses. And you could possibly even lose your job. So, what can you do to prevent drunk driving? Plan a safe ride home before you start drinking. Designate a sober driver or call a taxi. And if someone you know has been drinking, take their keys and arrange for them to get a sober ride home. We all know the consequences of driving drunk. But one thing's for sure, you're wrong if you think it's no big deal. Drive sober or get pulled over.
Football season is around the corner, and Podcast One Sportsnet has the best shows to help you build the best fantasy team in the league.
You can do it!
Break down all of the latest NFL news on Pro Football Focus Fantasy Football Podcast, then serve up some picks with Ross Tucker's Fantasy Feast.
Honestly, I think it's ridiculous in real life, let alone ridiculous in fantasy football.
Take a spin with the fantasy record or rise above with the Underdog Sports Fantasy Hour.
Just when you think this guy's going to come into a season fully healthy, it looks like he may not.
Dominate the competition and download new episodes of these shows and more every week on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Football is back, and the sports action in August just keeps getting better. Between the NFL and the UFC and the playoff race and Major League Baseball all happening, there is no better time to try your luck on the odds. This week in the NFL, it's the Ravens versus Eagles, the Packers against the Raiders, the Texans versus the Cowboys, and the Seahawks versus Chargers. There's only one place that has you covered and one place we trust, betonline.ag. Sign up today for a free account at betonline.ag and use the promo code podcast1 or Text BET NOW to 238-669 to receive a 50% welcome bonus. That's betonline.ag, your online sportsbook experts and exclusive partners of Podcast One Sportsnet.
This is Steve Austin Unleashed.
Did you always have those comedic skills? Were you funny as a kid? Were you the class clown?
Yeah, I was a class clown. I did some MC stuff at school. I was always a class clown. And then, you know, doing judo since 9, I found something that combined grappling and comedy. And it was like a perfect fit.
You know, see, that's the thing about it. Because you were so damn funny, I knew that you were technically proficient in the ring. But, you know, until I started reading about you, I had no idea you had a shoot background with judo. And you were also, you know, an amateur wrestler going back to university. What got you interested in judo, of all things? Because growing up in South Texas, we're not exposed to those things. And I know there's a 10 years between myself and you. Is Mississauga a hotbed for judo, or is that just something that's available in the area?
Yeah, no, it was a fluke. You know, I would watch kung fu movies and pro wrestling. And when I was 9 years old, I said, Ma, I gotta pursue martial arts. I'm destined to. Felt the calling, you know. So my mom looked in the Parks and Recreations magazine, and there was karate, kung fu, taekwondo, judo, all this aikido, and the one that fit her schedule happened to be judo. And judo has never been the most popular sport around here. It's popular around the world because it's an Olympic sport.
Yes,
but you know, it wasn't. It was never one of the main ones. Like karate and taekwondo and kung fu was always more popular. But I fell in love with judo, and it got in my blood. And yeah, I competed for Ontario, for Canada. I was national champion at one point when I was in university. Judo gave me, I joke around saying judo gave me all the skills I ever needed in life. Just, I moved away from home at 19 to go train with the national team, and just surrounded myself with Olympic athletes. And my whole thing was the 2000 Olympics. That was my goal since I was a young teenager. And yeah, you know, I did things like I sacrificed going to the, let's say, the school dance because I had a tournament the next day and I was cutting weight or whatever it was. And everybody that just had this regular school life, I had the school life, plus I had this whole judo life, you know, on the weekends. I was lucky because my parents are awesome. And my dad would drive me to provincial training camps on the weekends and drive, you know, 6 hours for a tournament. And I was really lucky, but the judo is slowing down a little bit now in terms of the amateur system here because of, you know, Brazilian jiu-jitsu is super popular,
right,
and MMA. So again, we're taking the back seat, but those that know judo know it's awesome.
It was interesting though, because you said judo fit into your mother's schedule. So that's what you ended up doing with the judo base and so much hip involvement. Is that rough on your hips? Do you feel any pain from all the years of judo?
It's funny because my hips are my last things. I haven't been injured yet, but I still have good hips. Actually, even when I do some judo, some of the guys are like, "Man, you still got your hips." But that's it. It is hard on the hips, especially when you do one throw. You kind of have to hit your hip out sideways to kind of get the right spot. So it can be pretty hard. But I had one of my throws. I would do this drop down throw where I'd drop on my knees and get underneath you and throw you over. I did that so much as a teenager that I had knee surgery at like 17 and 19, both legs, just because of the ferocity of the impact on the knees. Yeah. Judo guys are like, we're pretty crazy. It's just like wrestlers. And basically when I did my wrestling, I just adapted my judo to be able to compete in the wrestling rules. And then the transition to MMA was pretty easy because of all the grappling.
So how far did you take the MMA stuff?
I was in Japan and I went there to kind of learn to be a pro wrestler. And I found out that they just trained like the pro wrestlers and fighters train the same. So I did some competition, some pancration stuff. And then I did one fight, like a UFC style fight. And I lost. So I won a few fights before that. But, and then I got banned, so I got knocked out that fight. It was funny because I switched to southpaw, and I got punched right in the neck, like a judo James Bond judo chop to the neck.
Yeah.
And so I didn't get a concussion or knocked out. It was like an instant choke up. And then I overstayed my Japanese tourist visa, so I was banned from Japan for a year. And because I was doing really well and I was choking out everybody. The guys from Pride came to scout my fight, and you know, and then I got knocked out, and then I disappeared from Japan. So it looked like I couldn't process the loss and just took off.
What do with all the wrestling background, MMA background, and judo background? I mean, that's real alpha stuff. Like, how did you put the ego aside or put the alpha aside and transform into Santino with the gimmick walk and all the mannerisms? It was just it was a tremendous character. But how did you put all that aside to go there with Santino? Because I don't think a lot of guys could have done that. You have so many guys that come from shoot backgrounds, and they can fill gaps because they're premier wrestlers. But their mindset is, you know, I'm a real wrestler, and so they don't want to advance as far down the pro wrestling ranks as they should because
that's
of their
like
ego.
Shelton Benjamin comes to mind, Bobby Lashley, like tough guys, badass, wicked wrestlers, and you know, in the back of their head, I could tell they wanted to say, well, if this is real, I'd be the champion, you know, but it's not real. It's entertainment. And I had a coach called Rip Rogers, and Rip said, take all the goddamn phony judo bullshit and leave it at the doors. This is phony bullshit. And if I say someone's going to hit you in the head with a feather and you're going to get knocked out, guess what? You're getting knocked out. It's just as phony when you win as when you lose. And it was just exactly what I needed to hear, you know?
Yeah.
But it was because I did this Russian shoot fighter gimmick back in OVW. And there's some stuff online about that. And people are like, wow, why didn't you do this gimmick? And, you know, of course I wanted to be a badass wrestler, and guys like Eddie and Dean and Benoit and all those guys, and just Dynamite Kid. I started wrestling pretty late. I started training at 28. And I had my first match at 29, 30, I was in Japan, 31, I went to OVW, 32, I got signed, 33, I debuted, and I'm talking about, I'm still green at 33.
Yes.
So I was pretty appreciative of the opportunity, and I wasn't, you know, I never knocked on the door and said, hey, Vince, I'm pissed off, or I actually knocked on the door one time and said, hey, Vince, I just want to let you know everything's okay, because no, everyone that goes in there has an issue, and I was happy. I said, hey, you can give me lemons all day. I'm going to make you the best lemonade you ever tasted.
Any other pearls of wisdom from Rip Rogers?
Oh, gosh. He's the best. He's like a prodigy.
Absolutely.
I got to tell you this one. I got to tell you this funny story because this is unbelievable. So there's this guy. His wrestling name was White Power. And he's from Alabama, and he met this girl. And 2 weeks before they met, he got pregnant. But you know, she didn't know for a while. Then she was scared to tell him, and he just thought she was gaining weight. And so he's telling me this one day. Now she's like 7 months pregnant. He's like, yeah, my girlfriend just told me, you know, she's pregnant. I'm like, whoa. So we go to morning practice. We used to do this morning practice, a private class. Rip would come straight. He worked all night in a Circle K, like the night shift. And he would come at 8 a.m. and, you know, you throw him $20 and you get a little private session, and it was amazing the amount of knowledge he was giving us at that time because the individual attention. So I walk in and I go, Rip, I go, guess what happened to Power? And he looked at him and goes, fell in love with a pregnant girl. And I'm like, how is that even an option? How did you guess that? And he blew my mind. He's like a, well, I don't want to say idiot savant because he's not an idiot, but
he knows what's up.
Yeah, he knows what's up.
He'd been around
too well.
What got you interested in the business to begin with? I mean, I started watching in South Texas when I was 7, 8 years old. Were you watching WWF or whatever back in the day?
Yeah. But all we got on our TV was WWF. And, you know, I have an older brother, 3 years. And to be honest, pro wrestling, it's funny because, you know, my mother's side is a French-Canadian up in Ontario. And my dad's side is obviously from Italy. But everybody watched wrestling on the weekends. So, you know, Hulkamania, fell in love with it. When I was a kid, I would stand up on the chair at dinner and have somebody introduce me to the table, just to do an introduction. And I love the show. You know, it's funny because I remember being like, I don't know, 13, 14, saying, I know I'm an artist. I know I'm an artist, but like, you know, I can't sculpt. I can't paint. I'm not a musician. And then later in life, I go, my canvas is the wrestling canvas. I'm that kind of artist. And if I could sing better, I would have saved my neck. But, yeah, that was my art form.
So what was your introduction to the business, or as far as training for it? Was it straight down to OVW? How'd you start?
Oh, no. Yeah, yeah. So I'm at Concordia University, and I meet this guy, one of my best friends to this day, Jordan. And his dad was Don Koloff, this a wrestler. He's from Bulgaria. He was a world multiple-time world medalist, and he was wrestling in Calgary when WWF kind of acquired Stampede Wrestling. And he was one of the six guys. You know, Stu said, take this guy. He's a good hand, whatever. No sense of humor, my coach, Don Koloff. Yeah. But like old-school crowbar, if anyone came to the dungeon, there was go wrestle with Don, and he would Don was the man. He's still the man. He's still a tank. He's like 68. He's all neck, you know. He's awesome. So anyway, his son was in my wrestling team. And when I found out his dad was in the WWF and had this little private school just north of Toronto, and I was like, the bells were not, you know, I just went, oh my God, I just found my goddamn destiny. And the feeling was very eerie now that I look back, because that was it. I found it, you know, and I had to graduate university and do all that stuff. And I knew what I was going to do. And, I set out and I trained with him for a year. And then I realized that the Ontario indie scene at the time was, you know, there's no social media, right? So no one's seeing any of the stuff you're doing. So I had to go and put myself in front of the right eyes. And that's when I packed up and knelt down and told my daughter, Daddy's going on a mission and I'm going to be back. And when I come back, I'm going to bring you to Hollywood. And we went out there and we went on a mission.
So you had a daughter at that time?
Yeah, I had a daughter during university.
So when you started training, and you said you're training there for a year, you know, my training was training with about 25, 30 other people in the same class, let's say. You know, ring time was limited. So we learned a little bit of chain wrestling, but first we learned how to do flat back bump, a little bit of tumbling, and really that was about it. And then kind of school was over, and, you know, I made my debut, and I was underprepared just because I was so damn green. What did your training consist of where you said you found your damn destiny?
In the beginning, so Coach, Don Koloff, we call him Coach, he had a gym, and he had one of the first cages. So I would go, and I'd be grappling with his son and another guy who was like a world sambo champion. And we'd just be doing the MMA side. But there was a pro wrestling ring on the other side, and there'd be some of his students. And it was a small group. Like, when I trained, there was like four of us.
Right.
And so Coach had this little gym that was kind of a little hangout man cave. He loved, you know, to get in there and teach some stuff. And then I thought it was too small, because I'm one of the smaller guys in the locker room when I was there. And he goes, no, you know, Owen Hart was your size. And I said, no way. I said, well, if this is not going to be an obstacle, then, you know, I'm in. This was the decision before. And then we'd go up every Tuesday, Thursday, and half the class was amateur wrestling and little submissions. And at the end, we do a little tackle drop down, get it again. And the physical side was easy. But the psychology side was, well, that's when I needed Rip Rogers. My first wrestling match, someone put in a word for me and had a little match in Ontario. And I swear, I thought it was partially shoot, because Coach is telling me, listen, don't let these guys take advantage. Like, if they're gonna just start giving you the beats, don't sell it. Take over. So I went in there, and my first five matches, I actually just met a guy a few weeks ago. Jake O'Reilly wrestles here in Ontario, and I haven't seen him since one of my, you know, the time I wrestled him. Shit, that would have been 13 years ago. And I said, hey, Jake O'Reilly, long time no see. I said, I want to apologize for the beating. I just, my first few guys, they got beatings. And I'd see them talking after the match, kind of raising their hands saying, what the fuck was that? This guy just beat me up. So I had to learn. There was a big learning curve.
Were they not smart to your amateur background or your judo?
Oh, no, they knew. They knew. They just didn't do anything about it.
Oh, Jesus Christ. You know, going into my first match there in the Dallas Sportatorium, you know, Chris Adams, my instructor, didn't even smarten us up that it was a work, because, you know, you didn't smarten anybody up in the business back then. I mean, this is back when it was still quote-unquote real. So finally, we were at the top.
How old are you here?
Oh, man, I was 24 years old. I just came.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I just got finished playing college football. I was in good shape. I was a good-looking kid with long blonde hair. And, you know, I kept, you know, I was watching. I was like, man, I know something's going on, but I don't know what's going on. And, you know, I know how they called a match in the ring and, you know, to it for a finish and stuff like that. But, you know, we protected the business back then. Did you always know that it was a work?
Well, I'd see guys in headlocks kind of talking to each other when I was a kid. And I'm like, ah, oh, man, they're telling you what to do. And, you know, so I had an idea. But then, you know, you always kind of want to believe. So you'll say to yourself, yeah, I mean, it's fake, but sometimes it gets real. Sometimes they get carried away, or you could tell these guys have a real problem with each other and they're going to solve it in the ring. And so, you know, like you said, you don't know how much. But I had an idea.
Yeah, I wanted to go back just because one thing you said about 5 minutes ago when you asked Koloff, you know, hey, man, am I big enough to do this? Or if this is going to be almost a waste of time, I shouldn't do it. I think that was a very smart thing to consider, because I don't think a lot of people take into consideration, you know, their physical merits or mental merits or things that are going to help them. Let's just say, okay, someone walks in. Whatever height and weight they are, hey, man, what's the pros and what's the cons to who and what I am as far as it relates to trying to get over or be successful in this business? And so I always like to – I just want to point that out, because, you know, a lot of people – it's not for everybody, and not everybody's cut out for it. And sometimes you'd like to say that, hey, man, you can overcome anything in life, or but that's not necessarily true.
And if you do that, you're doing them a disservice.
Yeah, I mean, I think you need to take an honest approach, and you took an assessment, and hey, it worked out for you.
Yeah, he put the number in my head, 230, to get to 230 pounds, and I got to 220 something, pretty good shape, and that was good enough to get signed. But now that I'm a coach, and you know, I have, let's say, 30, 40 students, and I'll be honest, and I said, listen, if you want to pay your fee and you want to come join the pro wrestling club and play around and do our student shows, that's absolutely fine. But if you look me in the eye and you tell me you want to do this for a living, well, then I'm going to be real with you. And I have a couple kids that are really, they're great, talented, 5'11", 6 feet. You can't walk around and you can't show up at 160. You can't show up at 138 pounds. You're going to get hurt. And I'd be doing you a disservice if I said you wouldn't. And I've become brutally honest with these guys. And it's the same thing. And I got that from Rip too. He's, you know, he'd swear a lot more, but he'd say, if you're a fat piece of crap, you know, eat tuna and work out. And if you're skinny, you know, lift weights and bulk up. And, you know, this, you don't have to go figure it out. All the answers are out there, but you have to be realistic. And then there's guys like, right now, James Ellsworth, and there was Spike Dudley, and just having them kept that hope alive, you know, there, so there is a chance, you know, because those guys have been there, and from time to time they get these little scrawny guys, and it sets up a lot of young kids for disappointment.
Yeah, but sometimes, you know, there's that spot that's custom made for that person, but, you know, it's not like it's, you know, always going to be there, but sometimes that opportunity opens up. And, you know, like a James Ellsworth, I mean, right now he's figured in real good. It's a great spot, and see how long it lasts. Let's shift gears, because before I was talking to you, I called you on the telephone and I said, hey, man, you got time to do the podcast? And I asked you what you were doing, and I said, well, I'm fixing to go coach this. I'm fixing to go coach that. I mean, you're teaching pro wrestling. You're teaching MMA, correct?
I coach the judo.
Okay, so you coach the judo, but you also have a pro wrestling school, correct?
Yeah. We do pro wrestling and MMA, and we focus on the three Olympic combative sports, so Olympic wrestling, judo, and boxing. And we have, you know, we're a part of Boxing Ontario and Judo Ontario and all that stuff. And then we have the MMA guys, like the Thai boxing, the submission wrestling. So when I trained in Japan at the original Battle Arts, That school closed down while I was on the road with WWE. And one time I was back in Japan and I met up with Yuki Ishikawa, who was the owner of the original Battle Arts. And he was trained by, like, you know, Carl Gotch and Fujiwara. And he's a walking encyclopedia when it comes to submissions. And he was retired from wrestling, semi-retired, driving truck. And I said, would you consider coming to Canada? And he's like, I'm there. So I said, excellent. And I got called, and he's the reason I opened Battle Arts, because I knew that these guys were going to be getting a world-class education with regards to submissions and stuff. So I got on the horn, got an immigration lawyer, and then we got him here. And yeah, the stuff he's done with these kids, his specialty is taking an average person and making them really good at grappling. And then, God forbid, an awesome athlete walks in, and he's going to become a super grappler athlete. And we have some wicked athletes down here.
Okay, let's talk about the pro wrestling part of it. That's the part in which you head, right? I mean, you're the head of all of it. You own it, but you're leading that class.
Yeah, so Toy does his name's Toyo Hikos, we call him Toy. He does the foundations, and then, you know, being up there for so long and listening to how many conversations I've had with Arn and Mike Rotundo and Ted Finley and all these guys. So I know exactly what they want. And, you know, even Scott Armstrong, we're watching local indie guys have a tryout match. And I know exactly what WWE is looking for, and I'll critique and polish up the psychology. And if there's bad habits they have, I'll tell them, listen, this is a direct from Vince. You know, don't put your hands on the ropes and keep them there when someone's giving you a shoulder in the stomach. It's a pet peeve for him. And again, plus it doesn't make sense anyway. But so they have a really, really good education. And then what we do is we have a show once a month, and, you know, family and friends, and we pack up. So in my gym, I have a little arena called the Don Koloff Arena, and we could comfortably, you know, sit 400 people, and we put on shows. Originally it was pro wrestling, but then the byproduct is I got this awesome venue and we do boxing, kickboxing. It's wicked. I just getting my liquor license too, so it's going to be really good now. And then we sit down, we watch the tape. I pause it. I'm sure they get sick of how much I pause it, and I critique everything, and I'm just honest with them. And I'm like, pause. Let's say I look at my one of my students, Martin. I go, Martin, that punch was shit. Come on, man, practice, you know, like I have to be honest with them when we critique it. So they're getting a wicked education.
And, you know, that's the thing about it is it's hard to find someone that's going to be honest with you. This is back in the old days from when I broke in. There was a lot of guys who just wanted to, you know, try to throttle somebody and make them do a bunch of Hindu squats and take their money and run off. But, you know, when you have someone, you know, and you know, like the veterans that I came up against or with, and they gave me, you know, real knowledge and said, hey, man, you know, what about this? Or, you know, slow down, or, you know, just give you actual, you know, straight up shoot fact information and not bullshit and beating around the bush. And yeah, you know, I think you have to have that as a young kid coming up, because if you don't, you're at the wrong place.
Yeah, because you're going to make every mistake. But if you make it and you're not aware that you made it, well, you're gonna keep making it. So you need someone there to definitely point it out. And we have this weird thing. So I guess our reputation is really good now, because we got guys from France, from Australia, two guys, United States, England. They come from all over the world to train with Toy and Battle Arts. And one of our he's a wrestler, but he got hired as a referee down at NXT. And he's like, yeah, the reputation down in NXT is you know, the reputation of Battle Arts is really good. And so because what we used to do is some of the earlier matches, like the young guys that aren't kind of our main guys yet, we'll make them shoot 2 hours before a submission wrestling match, and the guy that wins gets to win that night in the show, which for me, for my dollar, is the most entertaining thing you could possibly do. It's awesome because these guys do not want to lose because they want to win tonight in front of their friends. And it's awesome.
Man, I got a direct message from you on Twitter, and you said you'd recently got into hunting, and that's what I'm down here in South Texas doing. And man, it was a surprising message that I got from you, because I just never figured you were into hunting at all. So what struck you to decide to take up hunting?
Well, it's funny. When I was in Japan in 2004, there was a guy from Wisconsin. He was a white guy and trained with us, and we became buddies. And he would always, he was an avid hunter. You know, I mean, he lived in a cabin like full time. And he just educated me a lot, and I always wanted to do it. And then, of course, when I was on the road, you know, there's no time. So I've been wanting to get into hunting for about 12, 13 years. And now that, you know, so basically I kind of officially retired in July of this year. And I went hunting with a buddy of mine, Jeremy Latour. He's a national wrestling champion. He's actually going to have a tryout at NXT. He's about 6'6", big Chewbacca. He's like a Jack Swagger. and he's an avid hunter. He's recently up in Barrie, Ontario. So we went up and we walked through the woods, and you know, I'm like, damn, how have I? It was even better than I thought it would be. And you know, like Ted DiBiase Jr. And he'd be telling me hunting stories, and just some of the boys hunt, and I just was always so interested in their stories that I actually had a pretty good like foundation of knowledge just from asking questions. And you know, but now I just took my course. My wife is the best, and for our first year anniversary, she bought me a Benelli shotgun, and I was very impressed by her choice of weapon.
A great choice.
Yeah. And I just actually just bought my bow this weekend. And I think that's going to be my favorite way to hunt, is get up in the tree stand and with my bow. And I think that's my thing.
When you said you took your hunting course, what all did that entail?
Oh, man. There's a place called Wolf's Den up in Barrie, Ontario. And it's the first one, because in Canada, like when I was living in Tampa, I just bought a gun in like half an hour and gave him my social security number, and that was it. So here in Canada, no way, you have to have a rifle or a shotgun is a non-restricted firearms, but you have to go do a whole course, and you have to have your PAL, which is like a permission to acquire a license, whatever. And it's a pretty good course, man. I learned a lot about guns and all the different lever action, hinge action, and calibers and all that stuff, and you know, safety. And that was one day. So we did this test, and I got like 100% because I was totally into it. And the next day is the hunting course. So it's a full day, a full weekend. And the first day was like, gosh, we were there at six in the morning till about 14-15 hours. So I was tired, and I was actually stressed because I haven't taken a test since university. And I'm like, geez, I don't know how my old memory is doing. But yeah, because I was interested, I paid attention.
What all did they teach you there? I mean, long story short, because, you know, I grew up following my dad in the woods with my two brothers, and we were making a bunch of noise. I mean, that was kind of my learning and introduction. I took my, you know, hunter safety course. But like when they teach you a hunting course and you're going for that long, what are they teaching you?
Oh, so they're teaching us, well, you know, we talked about what's in season, what's an ethical shot. And it was kind of talking about make sure that, you know, if you're not confident about the shot, you know, the worst thing you could do is obviously injure a poor animal and you know, not have a clean kill. You know, what to do if you get lost, you know, make sure you have your survival kit and start a fire and stay put, all that kind of stuff. You know, they talk about the for here. Okay, so for example, if I want to go get a buck, I have to go get a buck tag, and just the limits and regulations. And there's a different license for migratory birds, and how many geese you can get. Just there's a lot of information.
It's a total type thing, but I dig the fact that they're smarting you up on, hey, what is an ethical shot? Just because you have something in front of you and it's not presenting itself in the proper fashion, you don't just shoot. You wait for the right shot to come up, and then you take action. Not just any shot, an ethical shot. So I think that's damn good. As far as your bow, and a lot of people would just grab a bow and they say, I'm going bow hunting. Well, they're not proficient with that bow because they haven't spent enough time, enough hours, enough shots from different distances on a 3D target or whatever they're shooting at. So they're not proficient with that bow. How often do you practice? I mean, you've got to love shooting to
get. Yeah, I love it. Well, I just bought the bow on Saturday. So Sunday was my I couldn't figure out why my left bicep was so sore, because I'm right-handed, but I'm left-eyed. So I practiced all day, and we're going up shooting. We're going up to a target practice, just targets, this week a couple times. I'm not going to practice on the animals. I'm going to make sure that I have a very reliable and consistent and confident shot before I actually go out in the woods and use it. But practice makes perfect 100%. And You got to just get really comfortable. My left bicep's still a little bit sore. I guess it was a different muscle, but yeah, I enjoy it. I love it.
What'd you end up getting, a compound bow?
Yeah, a compound bow. Yeah.
What brand was it?
PSC maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, PSC, and has a PSC Extreme or X Cross or something. It's in the car. Yeah, it was the guy measured out my draw length, and It's perfect. I love it.
Do you live in the city or on the outskirts of town or what?
I live in the suburbs. So like downtown Toronto is 20 minutes one way and up north is a good 40 minutes. And I'm pure country in about 40 minutes.
Man, I live in Marina Del Rey when I'm in California. Right now I'm in South Texas. I'm at my ranch. But when I'm practicing with my bow, I haven't practiced in a while because I just had my right shoulder rebuilt. But, you know, my yard is about 25 or 30 yards wide. And so I can't shoot all the way at the bushes. So I put my target, and I'm just shooting a square target. And it's about I just use one pin. It's a 20-yard pin. And then so when I'm shooting, I have a fence. It's a, you know, it's a brick fence, and it goes into wood. And then my neighbor, you know, before I knew him, I never would tell him when I was practicing, you know. But nowadays that I've become close with him, you know, I'm a good shot. But, you know, in theory, I could let one fly. It'd have to go 4 foot high. And I'm always thinking he's going to knock on my door. You know, when people put those little arrow things on their head, you know, where it looks like I got shot through the head. I figured my neighbor's going to come over and say, hey, man, thanks for the heads up. But
yeah, I was actually wondering the regulations. Like, it's one thing I don't know, because behind the gym, there's a huge field, like huge abandoned field, nothing going on there. And there's a big mound of dirt. And I can put a target in front of that, and I can shoot that all day. And there's nothing around there. Some police officers go up there to sleep sometimes, and, you know, when they're on shift. But, yeah, I don't know if I'm allowed, because it's considered a firearm here, a bow.
Yeah, you'll have such different laws up there. But anyway, enough about hunting. I hope you you keep up with bow and turn into an outstanding shot. And again, glad to hear the ethical shot standard in the classroom instruction. What do you have coming up next?
We are going to be doing something with the Fight Network next year, because it's a Canadian company and they need some Canadian content. So Scott D'Amore and I have become pretty good buddies over the last few years, and we're going to put together a like an elite Ontario indie wrestling program. And so that's in 2017. I just started with Sportsnet, and that's going great. Yeah, I'm just, you know what? This was my first, this year I had my first garden because I'm home now to water it. I'm just going to be enjoying the outdoors. And, you know, my new wife, she is my new wife, but we want to have babies. So that takes up some time. Hopefully next year we'll have a couple little bambinos running around, and just, I'm really just enjoying this new chapter of life after wrestling, and I love being a coach. I didn't think I'd love it that much. I never considered myself a coach. I love sitting the kids down and just trying to come up with the perfect phrase, the perfect sentence that just sparks this kind of passion and you know, like just to give them the aha moment. Where I said, listen, if you do this, this, and this, and if you're hungrier than this guy, you can be the world champion. And I'm not saying it to kids. I don't believe it to. And just seeing them go to tournaments and overcome their fear and win a match. And being a coach is really, really rewarding.
Let's get some props to our friends over at TrueCar for supporting the podcast from day one. With TrueCar, 60 seconds is all you'll need to get an offer for your car. And the amount of time it takes to floss your teeth, pet your dog, and do a few push-ups, you can get a True Cash offer. Best of all, you can do it from your smartphone or even from home. Just go to True Car and simply enter your license plate number and watch how your car's details pop up. Answer a few questions, and you'll get an accurate True Cash offer from a local True Car certified dealer. It's that easy. After that, you can bring your car in, and they'll check it out with you. Together, you can ask questions and get the answers you need, so there's no surprises. Then, simply leave with your check or trade in your car for a new ride. So when you're ready to experience a better way to sell or trade in your car, check out True Car today. True Cash offer not available in all areas. And hey, man, while you're online, you should get your car insurance figured out. Go to GEICO.com, and in 15 minutes, you can be saving 15% or more on car insurance. That's right. Save hundreds of dollars on car insurance at GEICO.com. Extra money in your pocket? It may just be the most rewarding thing you do today. All right, everybody, give me the go-home cue. It's time to wrap up this podcast and ride off in the sunset. Don't forget to rate and review the Steve Austin Show on Apple Podcasts and tell your friends to check us out.
And if you want to reach me here on the podcast, send an email to questions@steveaustinshow.com. One announcement I'd like to make real quick. Everybody's been asking me, Steve, when are you going to come out with some brand new t-shirt designs? It's been forever. Well, I'm here to announce right now, ProWrestlingTees.com has some Broken Skull Ranch shirts, but I'm here to announce my brand new line of t-shirts, which I'm very proud of, called Steve Austin's King of Attitude. Check out these badass shirts on ProWrestlingTees.com. Shirts will be available next Monday on the 26th as we head into the Labor Day sale, which everything will be 20% off. This will be the chance to jump on some of the most badass shirt designs you will ever see, capturing the King of Attitude in an era which was the most competitive and most profitable in the history of the professional wrestling business. Check out Steve Austin's King of Attitude series on ProWrestlingTees.com. And that's the bottom line. Don't forget, my new show, Straight Up Steve Austin, airs right after Monday Night Raw. Please make sure you tune in or set your DVRs. Hey, I got a badass beer. It's the best IPA in the United States of America, and it's really, really something you need to try. From El Segundo Brewing Company. You can find it at Whole Foods and Total Wines if you live in SoCal. If you're not in SoCal, check online and see if you can find some place that will send it your way. I got some badass pocket knives from Cold Steel, The Broken Skull, and The Working Man. Find them at my Amazon store. Amazon has the best price on both knives. Just go to amazon.com/shop/Steve Austin. Also, if you see me out there riding in the woods, you can bet your ass I'll be riding a Kawasaki. I want to say one more thank you to all the fine sponsors of the Steve Austin Show, especially TrueCar, Geico, and BetOnline.ag. That's how I'm able to do this podcast for you twice a week for free. Please support them because they support us. And if you need more info on my sponsors, check out the show description to this episode for details. Folks, I am on social media, Twitter and Instagram, at SteveAustinBSR. Until next time, folks, my name is Steve Austin, and I will catch your ass down the road.
Download new episodes of Steve Austin Unleashed every Thursday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.